Recorded Books presents The Canterbury Tales, The General Prologue and 12 Major Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer. Edited and hosted by Michael Murphy. Narrated by John Franklin Robbins, George Guidel, Ron Keith, Davina Porter, John Rayner, Barbara Rosenblatt, and Patrick Tull. This work is copyrighted 1991 by the University Press of America, Incorporated. This recording is copyrighted 1992 by Recorded Books. And now, Michael Murphy, Professor of English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York.
The book known as The Canterbury Tales is so called because it is a collection of tales told by pilgrims on a fictional medieval journey to Canterbury in England, to the shrine of St. Thomas Becket, who had been martyred there in the year 1170. The tales were written by Geoffrey Chaucer, who died in the year 1400, rather more than 200 years before the death of Shakespeare. Since living languages are always changing, it follows that Chaucer's language will be more different from ours than Shakespeare's is. For readers, this is most noticeable in the medieval spelling that is preserved in most editions of the tales. By contrast, the spelling in any edition of Shakespeare that you pick up is modern, even if some of the words are obsolete. This sensible editorial convention makes it unnecessary for Shakespeare readers to wrestle with the needless difficulties and uncertainties of the actual spelling of Shakespeare's own day. Shakespeare's verse is difficult enough as it is. The archaic spelling in every edition of Chaucer except ours is a severe obstacle for many people who do not want to fight the difficulties of the 14th century spelling of Chaucer any more than the oddities of the 16th century spelling of Shakespeare. Somewhere near the front of editions of Chaucer's work, there is nearly always a guide to Chaucer's pronunciation, and it is customary in college Chaucer classes to insist that students pronounce the words as Chaucer was supposed to have pronounced them, although the accuracy of this reconstructed pronunciation is quite dubious, as it is now 600 years since Chaucer was writing, and the evidence from that period of how English was pronounced ranges from slim to non-existent. There is some reason for scholars to try this reconstructed pronunciation, but not enough reason to impose it on general readers and on students, most of whom do not intend to be professional medievalists. The conviction behind our edition is that Chaucer can be read in standard modern spelling and heard in any standard spoken English. And by Chaucer we mean the language of Chaucer himself, not a translation. The language of the edition is Chaucer's language, line for line, word for word. Chaucer's grammar, Chaucer's vocabulary, Chaucer's sentence structure. The only things that we have modernized in accordance with the practice for all other authors are spelling and pronunciation. So there will be some obsolete and archaic words, but this is true of the work of any author from a former era, and even with an author as old as Chaucer, these expressions are never so numerous as to hold up seriously the meaning of the narrative. Much of the pain of fighting the archaic spelling and archaic sounds is eliminated, so readers and hearers learn quickly to enjoy Chaucer, not merely endure him. The poetry remains great after the elimination of the difficulty of old spelling and old pronunciation, a difficulty that did not exist, remember, for Chaucer's contemporaries. The Canterbury Tales begins with a general prologue, in which the poet tells us how he happened to meet these 29 pilgrims on the way to Canterbury, how they agreed to tell the tales at the suggestion of the landlord of the Tabard, the inn where they stopped in Southwark in South London, and how they all appeared to the poet. their habits, their speech, their clothes, their attitudes, and so on. His account of the pilgrims here, before any of them gets to tell a tale, is a verbal portrait gallery with word pictures of the individuals who will later tell the famous tales. It has often been remarked, and it is worth remarking again, that this portrait gallery provides a wonderful cross-section of 14th-century English society. Not a complete and comprehensive survey, for Chaucer is a poet, not a sociologist, but one remarkable for its diversity. There are men and women, clerics and laymen, young, middle-aged and old, people who differ widely in their spiritual lives, their economic status, their tastes in clothes, books and food, those who need to travel constantly, and those for whom this will be the one major journey of their life. Rogues and innocents, introverts and show-offs, saints, few, and sinners, many. Pronunciation has been modernized throughout, but because we have retained Chaucer's vocabulary intact, there are some archaic and obsolete words, words that we no longer use. Other words have changed their meaning over the years. Some words with changed meanings are gay, which means splendid or well-dressed, clerk, a cleric or student, dangerous, which does not mean dangerous, but something like cool or aloof, standoffish, often used to describe the attitude of a woman who does not want to appear to yield to a man too readily. Or it can apply to the rather effeminate Absalom, who is of speech dangerous, that is, fastidious. Or it can apply to the devout parish priest, who was not standoffish with sinners. He was not dangerous to them. Obsolete words include whilom, W-H-I-L-O-M, which means once upon a time, and appears at the beginning of many tales. In Flanders, whilom was a company, or whilom there was dwelling at Oxenford. Two unfamiliar words are used to introduce people's names. The first is Height, H-I-G-H-T, John Height that one, and Alan Height that other. John was the name of one, and Alan of the other. The second word is Cleped, C-L-E-P-E-D. She was Cleped, that is, she was called Madame Eglantine. Very common is the word Eke, E-K-E, which means also. Alison Carpenter wears a dress embroidered all before and eke behind, and on her collar about, of coal-black silk within and eke without. There are exclamations such as bensity or benedicity, meaning bless us or bless you. Old-fashioned cries of alarm like harrow and well away. Swink or swinken means to work. Think on God as we do, men that swink, says a working man, a carpenter, to a college student. I trow means I trust, I believe. God wot, W-O-T, is a common phrase meaning God knows. I wot well means I know well. Its past tense is wist, as in for well he wist, for well he knew, a woman has no beard. You will hear that ilka day in thilka town, meaning that same day in the same town. The adjective would, W-O-O-D, means crazy or mad, as in that favorite question of the lazy monk and of every lazy student. What, should he study and make himself and would? Drive himself mad. A common form of the negative is the particle ne, N-E, placed before the verb. The old man who wants to die laments that death, alas, ne will not have my life. Absalom refuses church offerings from any of the women. Of no wife, ne tuki, no offering. Notice that double or triple negatives are perfectly acceptable. Frequently, also, the negative before the verb is abbreviated, as it is today after the verb. Ne is appears as nis, the exact equivalent of modern isn't. Nas means wasn't. One result of speaking Chaucer's words in a modern pronunciation is that some of the words that rhymed for him do not rhyme fully for us. Was and glass were probably pronounced wass and glass. Some others apparently retained a rather Anglo-French pronunciation, which they have since lost. Religion and town were probably religion and tune. Cheer and matter were something like chair and mater. Serviceable and table probably came out as serviceable and table. But most of Chaucer's rhymes, like all of his great poems, still work for us as they did for him. Here are the first 18 lines of the general prologue as they might have sounded in Chaucer's day. When that April with his sure thought, the drucht of March hath persed to the rot, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur of which virtue engendered is the floor. When Zephyr's ache with his sweet breath in spirit hath in every holt and haith the tender croppeth, and the younger son hath in the ram his half course he run, and small fools maken melody that sleepen all the nicht with open e, so pricketh them nature in her courages, then longen folk to gon on pilgrimages, and palmers for to saken stronger strandes to ferne halwes, couth in sundry londes, and specially from every shearer's end of Engeland to Canterbury they wend, the holy blissful martyr for to sake, that him hath holpen when that they were sake. Here follows the general prologue read in modern pronunciation by John Franklin Robbins.
When that April with his showers suit, the drought of March hath pierced to the root, and bathed every vein in such liquor, of which virtue engendered is the flower, when Zephyrus eke with his sweet breath inspired hath in every holt and heath the tender crops, and the young sun hath in the ram his half course irun, and small fowls make a melody that sleepen all the night with open eye, so pricketh them nature in their courages. Then longen folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmers for to seek strange strands, to ferne hallows couth in sundry lands, and specially from every shire's end of England to Canterbury they wend, the holy blissful martyr for to seek, that them hath holpen when that they were sick. Befell that in that season, on a day in Southwark at the Tabard, as I lay ready to wenden on my pilgrimage to Canterbury with full devout courage, at night was come into that hostelry, well 29 in a company of sundry folk, by aventure ifall in fellowship, and pilgrims were they all that toward Canterbury wouldn't ride. The chambers and the stables were unwide, and well we were uneased at the best. And shortly, when the sun was to rest, so had I spoken with them every one that I was of their fellowship anon, and made a forward early for to rise to take our way there, as I you devise. But natheless, while I have time and space, ere that I further in this tale pace, methinketh it accordant to reason to tell you all the condition of each of them, so as it seemed me, and which they were, and of what degree, and eke in what array that they were in. And at a night, then, will I first begin. A knight there was, and that a worthy man, that from the time that he first began to riden out, he loved chivalry, truth and honour, freedom and courtesy. Full worthy was he in his lord's war, and thereto had he ridden, no man far, as well in Christendom as heathenness, and ever honoured for his worthiness. At Alexandry was, when it was won, full oftentime he had the board begun above an all nations in Prussia. In Lithuania had he rised, and in Russia, no Christian man so oft of his degree. In Granada, at the siege, eke had he be of Algesir, and ridden in Belmarie. At Layers was he, and at Satali, when they were won, and in the great sea, at many a noble army had he be. At mortal battles had he been 15, and fought for our faith at Tramisene, in lists thrice, and I slain his foe. This Ilka worthy knight had been also sometime with the Lord of Palatine, against another heathen in Turkey. And evermore he had a sovereign prize, and though that he was worthy, he was wise, and of his port as meek as is a maid. Ne'er never yet no villainy, he said, in all his life unto no manner wight. He was a very perfect gentle knight. But for to tellen you of his array, his horse was good, but he was not gay. A fustian he wearied a japoon, all besmoted with his habergeon, for he was lately come from his voyage, and went for to do his pilgrimage. With him there was his son, a young squire, a lover, and a lusty bachelor, with locks curled as they were laid in press. Of 20 years he was of age, I guess. Of his stature, he was of even length, and wonderly deliver, and of great strength, and he had been some time in Chivichy, in Flanders, in Artois, and Picardy, and borne him well, as in so little space, in hope to stand and in his lady's grace. Embroidered was he, as it were a mead, all full of fresh flowers, white and red. Singing he was, or fluting all the day, he was as fresh as is the month of May. Short was his gown, with sleeves long and wide. Well could he sit on horse and fair ride. He could songs make, and well indite, joust, and eke dance, and well portray and write. So hot he loved, that by night a tale he slept no more than does a nightingale. Courteous he was, lowly and serviceable, and carved before his father at the table. A yeoman he had, and servants no more at that time, for him list to ride so, and he was clad in coat and hood of green. A sheaf of peacock arrows, bright and keen, under his belt he bore full thriftily. Well could he dress his tackle yeomanly, his arrows drooped not with feathers low, and in his hand he bore a mighty bow. A knot-head had he with a brown visage, of woodcraft could he well all the usage. Upon his arm he bore a gay bracer, and by his side a sword and a buckler, and on that other side a gay dagger, harnessed well, and sharp as point of spear. A Christopher on his breast of silver sheen. A horn he bore, the baldric was of green. A forester was he, soothly, as I guess. There was also a nun, a prioress, that of her smiling was full simple and coy. Her greatest oath was but by Saint Eloy, and she was cleped Madam Eglantine. Full well she sang the service divine, entuned in her nose full seemly. And French she spoke, full fair and fetishly, after the school of Stratford at the Bow, for French of Paris was to her unknow. At meat well y taught was she withal. She let no morsel from her lips fall, nor wet her fingers in her sauce deep. Well could she carry a morsel, and well keep that no drop fell upon her breast. in courtesy, was set full much her lest. Her overlip wiped she so clean, that in her cup there was no farthing seen of grease, when she drunken had her draught. Full seemly after her meat she wrought, and certainly she was of great disport, and full pleasant and amiable of port, and pained her to counterfeit cheer of court, and be stately of manner, and to beholden dine of reverence. But for to speak of her conscience, she was so charitable and so piteous, she would weep if that she saw a mouse caught in a trap, if it were dead or bled. Of small hounds had she, that she fed with roasted flesh or milk and wastel bread, but sore wept she if one of them were dead, or if men smote it with a yard smart, and all was conscience and tender heart. Full seemly her wimple pinched was, her nose treatise, her iron grey as glass, her mouth full small and thereto soft and red, but certainly she had a fair forehead, it was almost a span broad, I trow, for hardily she was not undergrow. Full fetish was her cloak, as I was ware, of small coral, about her arm she bore a pair of beads, gauded all with green, and thereon hung a brooch of gold, full sheen, on which was written first a crowned A, and after Amor vincit omnia. Another nun with her had she, that was her chaplain, and priests three. A monk there was, a fair for the mastery, an outrider that loved venery, a manly man, to be an abbot able. Full many a dainty horse had he in stable, and when he rode, men might his bridle hear jingle in a whistling wind as clear and eke as loud as does the chapel bell there as this lord is keeper of the cell. The rule of St. Maur, or of St. Bennet, because that it was old and some deal straight, this ilka monk let old things pass, and held after the new world the sparse. He gave not of that text a pulled hen, that says that hunters be not holy men, nor that a monk, when he is reckless, is likened to a fish that's waterless, that is to say, a monk out of his cloister. But vilka text held he not worth an oyster. And I said his opinion was good. What, should he study and make himself and wood upon a book in cloister always to pore? Or swinken with his hands and labour as Austin bids? How shall the world be served? Let Austin have his swink to him reserved. Therefore he was a pricker sore aright. Greyhounds he had as swift as fowl in flight. Of pricking and of hunting for the hare was all his lust, for no cost would he spare. I saw his sleeves purfled at the hand with gree, and that the finest of the land. And for to fasten his hood under his chin, he had of gold wrought a full curious pin, a love knot on the greater end there was. His head was bald, that shone as any glass, and eke his face, as he had been anoint. He was a lord full fat, and did good point, his iron steep and rolling in his head, that steamed as a furnace of a lead. His boots supple, his horse in great estate. Now, certainly, he was a fair prelate. He was not pale as a forpined ghost. A fat swan loved he best of any roast. His palfrey was as brown as any berry. A friar there was, a wanton and a merry, a limiter, a full solemne man. In all the orders four is none that can so much of dalliance and fair language. He had made full many a marriage of young women at his own cost. Unto his order he was a noble post. Full well beloved and familiar was he with franklins over all in his country, and eke with worthy women of the town, for he had power of confession, as said himself, more than a curate, for of his order he was licentiate. Full sweetly heard he confession, and pleasant was his absolution. He was an easy man to give penance, there as he wist to have a good pittance. For unto a poor order for to give is sign that a man is welly shrive. For if he gave, he durst make a vaunt, he wist that a man was repentant. For many a man so hard is of his heart, he may not weep, though that he sore smart.
Therefore, instead of weeping and prayers, men may give silver to the poor frères. His tippet was aye farced, full of knives and pins for to given fair wives, and certainly had a merry note. Well could he sing and play on a rote. Of yeddings he bore utterly the prize. His neck white was, as is the fleur-de-lis. Thereto he strong was as a champion. He knew the taverns well in every town, and every hosteler and tapster, better than a lazar or a beggister. For unto such a worthy man as he, accorded not as by his faculty to have with sick lazars acquaintance. It is not honest, it may not advance, for to deal him with no such parail, but all with rich and sellers of vitail. And over all there as profit should arise, courteous he was, and lowly of service. There was no man nowhere so virtuous. He was the best beggar in his house, and gave a certain farm for the grant. None of his brethren came there in his haunt. For though a widow had not a shoe, so pleasant was his in principio, that he would have a farthing ere he went. His purchase was well better than his rent. And rage he could, as it were right a whelp. In love days there could he muchel help, for there he was not like a cloisterer, with a threadbare cope, as is a poor scholar, but he was like a master or a pope. Of double worsted was his semi-cope, and rounded as a bell out of the press. Somewhat he lisped for his wantonness to make his English sweet upon his tongue. And in his harping, when that he had sung, his iron twinkled in his head aright, as do the stars in the frosty night. This worthy limiter was Cleped Hubert. A merchant was there, with a forked beard, in motley, and high on horse he sat. Upon his head a Flandrish beaver hat, his boots clasped fair and fetishly. His reasons he spoke full solemnly, sounding always the increase of his winning. He would the sea were kept for anything betwixt Middleburgh and Orwell. Well could he in exchange shields sell. This worthy man full well his wit beset. There wist no wight that he was in debt. So stately was he of his governance, with his bargains and with his chevisance. Forsooth, he was a worthy man withal, but sooth to say, I not how men him call. A clerk there was of Oxenford also, that unto logic had long ago. As lean was his horse as is a rake, and he was not right fat, I undertake, but looked hollow, and thereto soberly.
Full threadbare was his overest courtepy, for he had gotten him yet no benefice, nor was so worldly for to have office. For him was lever have at his bed's head 20 books, clad in black or red, of Aristotle and his philosophy, than robes rich, or fiddle, or gay psaltery.
But albeit that he was a philosopher, yet had he but little gold in coffer. But all that he might of his friends hent, on books and on learning he it spent, and busily gan for the soul's prey of them that gave him wherewith to scholae. Of study took he most care and most heed. Not one word spoke he more than was need, and that was spoke in form and reverence, and short and quick, and full of high sentence. Sounding in moral virtue was his speech, and gladly would he learn, and gladly teach. A sergeant of the law, wary and wise, that often had been at the parvise there was also, full rich of excellence. Discreet he was, and of great reverence. He seemed such, his words were so wise. Justice he was, full often in assize, by patent and by plain commission. For his science and for his high renown, of fees and robes had he many a one. So great a purchaser was nowhere none. All was fee simple to him, in effect. His purchasing might not be in fact. Nowhere so busy a man as he there nas, and yet he seemed busier than he was. In terms had he case and dooms all, that from the time of King William were fall. Thereto he could indite and make a thing. There could no wight pinch at his writing, and every statute could he plain by rote. He rode but homely in a medley coat, girt with a saint of silk with bars small. Of his array tell I no longer tale. A franklin was in his company. White was his beard, as is the daisy. Of his complexion he was sanguine. Well loved he by the morrow a sop in wine. To live in delight was ever his one, for he was Epicurus's own son, that held opinion that plain delight was very felicity perfite. A householder, and that a great was he. St. Julian he was in his country. His bread, his ale, was always after one. A better invined man was never none. Withouten baked meat was never his house, of fish and flesh, and that so plenteous, it snowed in his house of meat and drink, of all dainties that men could bethink. After the sundry seasons of the year, so changed he his meat and his supper. Full many a fat partridge had he in mew, and many a bream, and many a luce in stew. Woe was his cook, but if his sauce were poignant and sharp, and ready all his gear. His table, dormant in his hall alway, stood ready covered all the long day. At sessions there was he lord and sire. Full often time he was knight of the shire. An anlace and a gypsum all of silk hung at his girdle, white as morning milk. A sheriff had he been, and a counter. Was nowhere such a worthy vavasour. A haberdasher and a carpenter, a webber, a dyer, and a tapisser. And they were clothed all in one livery of a solemn and a great fraternity. Full fresh and new their gear apiked was. Their knives were chaped not with brass, but all with silver. Wrought full clean and well their girdles and their pouches every deal. Well seemed each of them a fair burgess to sitten in a guild hall on a dais. Ever each for the wisdom that he can was shapely for to be an alderman. For chattels had they enough and rent, and eke their wives would it well assent, and else certainly they were to blame. It is full fair to be yclept, madame, and go to vigils all before, and have a mantle royally bore. A cook they had with them for the nones, to boil the chickens and the marrow-bones, and powder merchant tart and galingale. Well could he know a draught of London ale. He could roast, and seethe, and broil, and fry, make mortrues, and well bake a pie. But great harm was it, as it thought me, that on his shin a mormal had he, for blancmange, that made he with the best. A shipman was there, woning far by west. For aught I wot, he was of Dartmouth. He rode upon a rouncy, as he couth, in a gown of folding to the knee. A dagger hanging on a lace had he about his neck, under his arm adown. The hot summer had made his hue all brown, and certainly he was a good fellow. Full many a draught of wine had he draw from Bordeaux ward, while that the chapman sleep. Of nice conscience took he no keep. If that he fought and had the higher hand, by water he sent them home to every land. But of his craft to reckon well his tides, his streams and his dangers him besides, his harbourer, his moon, his loadmanage, there was none such from Hull unto Carthage. Hardy he was, and wise to undertake. With many a tempest had his beard been shake. He knew all the havens as they were, from Gothland to the Cape of Finisterre, and every creek in Brittany and Spain. His barge eclipid was the Mordelaine.
When that they comen somewhat out of town, this summoner to his brother gan to roun. "Brother," quod he, "here wones an old Rebeck, that had almost as lief to lose her neck as for to give a penny of her good. I will have 12 pence, though that she be wood, or I will summon her unto our office. And yet, God wot, of her know I no vice. But for thou canst not, as in this country, win in thy cost, take here example of me." This summoner clappeth at the widow's gate. "Come out," quod he, "thou old viritrate. I trow thou hast some friar or priest with thee."
"Who clappeth?"
said this wife.
"Benedicity, God save you, sir, what is your sweet will?"
"I have," quod he, "of summons here a bill. On pain of cursing, look that thou be to-morrow before the archdeacon's knee to answer to the court of certain things."
"Now, Lord," quod she, "Christ Jesus, King of Kings, so wisely help me as I ne may. I have been sick, and that full many a day. I may not go so far," quod she, "nor ride, but I be dead, so pricks it in my side. May I not ask a libel, Sir Summoner, and answer there by my procurator to such thing as men will oppose in me?"
"Yes," quod this summoner, "pay anon, let's see, 12 pence to me, and I will thee acquit. I shall no profit have thereby but little. My master has the profit, and not I. Come off, and let me ride in hastily. Give me 12 pence, I may no longer tarry."
12 pence? Quod she. "Now, Lady St. Mary, so wisely help me out of care and sin, this wide world, though that I should it win, ne'er have I not 12 pence within my hold. You know and well that I am poor and old. Kith your almus upon me, a poor wretch."
"Nay, then," quod he, "the foul fiend me fetch, if I thee excuse, though thou shouldst be spilt."
"Alas," quod she, "God wot, I have no guilt."
"Pay me," quod he, "or by the sweet Saint Anne, as I will bear away thy new pan, for debt which that thou owest me of old, when that thou madest thy husband a cuckold, I paid at home for thy correction."
"Thou liest," quod she, "by my salvation, ne'er was I ne'er ere now, widow nor wife, summoned unto your court in all my life. Nay, never I was but of my body true. Unto the devil, rough and black of hue, give I thy body and my pan also."
And when the devil heard her cursing so upon her knees, he said in this manner, "Now, Mabel, mine own mother dear, is this your will in earnest that you say?"
"The devil," quod she, "so fetch him ere he die, and pan, and all, but he will him repent."
"Nay, old stot, that is not mine intent," quod this summoner, "for to repent me for anything that I have had of thee, I would I had thy smock and every cloth."
"Now, brother," quod the devil, "be not wroth. Thy body and this pan be mine by right.
Thou shalt with me to hell yet to-night, where thou shalt known of our privity more than a master of divinity. And with that word the foul fiend him hent. Body and soul he with the devil went, whereas these summoners have their heritage. And God that made after his image mankind, save and guide us all and some, and leave these summoners good men to become.
Lordings, I could have told you, quod this friar, had I had leisure of this summoner here, after the text of Christ and Paul and John and of our other doctors, many a one, such pains that your hearts might agrize, albeit so no tongue may it devise, though that I might 1,000 winters tell the pains of thilk cursed house of hell. But for to keep us from that cursed place, waketh, and prayeth Jesus of his grace, so keep us from the tempter Satanus. Hearken this word, beware as in this case. The lion sits in his await alway to slay the innocent, if that he may. Disposeth I your hearts to withstand the fiend that would you make enthrall and bond. He may not tempt you over your might, for Christ will be your champion and your knight, and prayeth that these summoners them repent of their misdeeds, ere that the fiend them hent. This summoner, in his stirrups high he stood. Upon this friar his heart was so wood that like an aspen leaf he quoke for ire. "Lordings," quoth he, "but one thing I desire. I you beseech that of your courtesy, since you have heard this false friar lie, as suffer me I may my tale tell. This friar boasteth that he knoweth hell, and God it wot that it is little wonder. Friars and fiends be but little asunder. For, pardy, you have oftentime heard tell how that a friar ravished was to hell in spirit once by a vision, and as an angel led him up and down to show in him the pains that were there, in all the place saw he not a freer. Of other folk he saw enough in woe. Unto this angel spoke the friar, though. Now, sir," quod he, "have friars such a grace that none of them shall come into this place?" "Yes," quod this angel, "many a million." And unto Satanus he led him down. "And now has Satanus," said he, "a tail broader than of a carrack is the sail. Hold up thy tail, thou Satanus," quod he, "show forth thine arse, and let the friar see where is the nest of friars in this place." And ere that half a furlong way of space, right so as bees out swarming from a hive, out of the devil's arse there gan to drive 20,000 friars on a rout, and throughout hell swarmed all about, and came again as fast as they may go, and in his arse they crept him, every one. He clapped his tail again, and lay full still. This friar, when he looked, had his fill upon the torments of this sorry place. His spirit God restored of his grace unto his body again, and he awoke. But natheless for fear yet he quoke, "So was the devil's arse aye in his mind. That is his heritage of very kind. God save you all. Save this cursed freer."
Here ends the Friar's Tale. The host boisterously invites the quiet Oxford scholar, the clerk, to break his reticence and tell a tale. Obediently, like the main character in his tale, the clerk complies, and like the scholar he is, he acknowledges the source of his tale, a work by the Italian poet Petrarch, and starts with a slightly pedantic lecture on the geography of Italy in which his tale is set. His tale of the patient wife Griselda, who endures without complaint the mental cruelties of her husband Walter, has fascinated and repelled both modern and medieval audiences. Petrarch felt obliged to point out that it is not meant to be taken literally, but is a parable illustrating how the faithful soul should endure the hardships which God sends. Chaucer professes to follow him in this, and Harry Bailey, the host, calls the story a legend, like a saint's life in the Golden Legend, the title of a great medieval collection of saints' lives. A problem with this reading, however, is that one may find it difficult to take the cruel, wife-beating whims of Walter as something godlike. It is much more like the actions of the persecutors of the martyrs in the Golden Legend. Sympathizing with Griselda against her tormentor is almost impossible to avoid, which would mean allegorically siding against God. If Walter is God, in some way, the tale may well be read as a questioning of the lesson it professes to inculcate. It may suggest that God is cruel, arbitrary, whimsically tyrannical. The question may occur, is the price demanded for the Lord's favor excessive? Whether you read Lord with a lowercase L or a capital. Read in this way, the tale is not really a very effective counterweight to the Wife of Bath's prologue, where Alison is presented as domineering, but never really cruel. In part one of the clerk's tale, the young ruler of Saluzzo, in Italy, is urged by his people to marry and beget an heir to ensure a peaceful succession of the same ruling family. He reluctantly agrees, on condition that they accept whomever he chooses. A wedding date is set. Here, then, is part one of the clerk's tale, which is read in its entirety by John Rayner.
"Sir Clerk of Oxenford," our host said, "you ride as coy and still as does a maid when you espoused sitting at the board. This day ne heard I of your tongue a word. I try you study about some sophism, but Solomon says, everything hath time. For God's sake, as be of better cheer, it is no time for to study here. Tell us some merry thing by your fay. For what man that is entered in a play, he needs must unto the play assent, but preacheth not, as friars do in Lent, to make us for our old sins weep, nor that thy tale make us not to sleep. Tell us some merry thing of aventures, your terms, your colours, and your figures. Keep them in store, till so be you indite high style, as when to kings men write. Speaketh so plain at this time, we you pray, that we may understand in what you say."
This worthy clerk benignly answered, "Host," quod he, "I am under your yard. You have of us as now the governance, and therefore will I do you obeisance, as far as reason asketh hardily. I will you tell a tale, which that I learned at Padua of a worthy clerk, as proved by his words and by his work. He is now dead, and nailed in his chest. I pray to God to give his soul rest. Francis Petrarch, the laureate poet, hight this clerk, whose rhetoric sweet illumined all Italy of poetry, as Linnean did of philosophy, or law, or other art particular. But death, that will not suffer us dwellen here, but as it were a twinkling of an eye, them both has slain, and all shall we die. but forth to tellen of this worthy man that taught me this tale as I began. I say first that with high style he inditeth, ere he the body of his tale writeth, a prohemy in which describeth he Piedmont, and of Saluzzo the country, and speaks of Apennines, the hills high that be the bounds of West Lombardy, and of Mount Vesulus in special, whereas the Po, out of a well small, taketh his first springing and his source, that eastward aye increaseth in his course to Emilia Ward, to Ferrara and Venice, the which a long thing were to devise. And truly, as to my judgment, methinketh it a thing impertinent, save that he will convey in his matter, but this his tale, which that you shall hear. There is, at the west side of Itale, down at the root of Vesulus the Cold, a lusty plain abundant of vitale, where many a tower and town thou mayst behold, that founded were in time of fathers old, and many another delectable sight, and Saluzzo this noble country height. A marquis, whilom lord, was of that land, as were his worthy elders him before, and obeisant, aye ready to his hand, were all his lieges, both less and more. Thus in delight he lives, and has done yore, beloved and dread through favour of fortune, both of his lords and of his commune. Therewith he was, to speak as of lineage, the gentlest born of Lombardy, a fair person, and strong, and young of age, and full of honour and of courtesy. Discreet enough his country for to guy, save in some things that he was to blame, and Walter was this young lord's name. I blame him thus, that he considered naught in time coming what might him betide, but on his last present was all his thought, as for to hawk and hunt on every side. Well nigh all other cures let he slide, and eke he nod, and that was worst of all, wed no wife for naught that may befall. Only that point his people bore so sore, that flock meal on a day they to him went, and one of them, that wisest was of law, or else that the Lord best would assent, that he should tell him what his people meant, or else could he show well such matter, he to the marquis said, as you shall hear, "Oh, noble marquis, your humanity assureth us, and give us hardiness, as oft as time is of necessity, that we to you may tell our heaviness. Accepteth, Lord, now of your gentleness, what we with piteous heart unto you plain, and let your ears not my voice disdain. All have I naught to do in this matter, more than another man has in this place. Yet forasmuch as you, my lord so dear, have always showed me favour and grace, I dare the better ask of you a space of audience to show an our request, and you, my lord, to do right as you list. For certes, lord, so well us liketh you and all your work, and ever have done, that we ne could we not ourselves devisen how we mighten live in more felicity. Save one thing, lord, if it your will be, that for to be a wedded man you list, then were your people in sovereign heart's rest. Boweth your neck under that blissful yoke of sovereignty, not of service, which that men cleep espousal or wedlock, and thinketh, lord, among your thoughts wise, how that our days pass in sundry wise, for though we sleep or wake or run or ride, aye flees the time, it nill no man abide. And though your green youth flower as yet, in creepeth age always, as still as stone, and death menaces every age, and smites in each estate, for there escapeth none, and all so certain as we know each one that we shall die, as uncertain we all be of that day when death shall on us fall. accepteth then of us the true intent, that never yet refuseden thy hest, and we will, Lord, if that you will assent, choose you a wife, in short time at the least, born of the gentlest and of the most of all this land, so that it ought to seem honour to God and you, as we can deem. Deliver us out of all this busy dread, and take a wife for high God's sake. For if it so befell, as God forbid, that through your death your lineage should slake, and that a strange successor should take your heritage, oh, woe were us alive! Wherefore we pray you hastily to wive. Their meek prayer and their piteous cheer made the Marquis's heart to have pity. You will, quod he, my own people dear, to that I never erst thought strain me. I me rejoiced of my liberty, that seldom time is found in marriage, where I was free I must be in servage. But natheless I see your true intent, and trust upon your wit, and have done I. Wherefore, of my free will I will assent to wed me as soon as ever I may. But there, as you have proffered me to-day to choose me a wife, I you release that choice, and pray you of that proffer cease. For God it wot, that children often been, unlike their worthy elders them before, bounty comes all of God, not of the strain of which they been engendered and ybore. I trust in God's bounty, and therefore my marriage and my estate and rest I him betake. He may do as him lest. Let me alone in choosing of my wife, that charge upon my back I will endure, but I you pray, and charge upon your life, that what wife that I take, you me assure to worship her, while that her life may dure in word and work both here and everywhere, as she an emperor's daughter were. And furthermore, this shall you swear, that ye against my choice shall neither grouch nor strive, for since I shall forego my liberty at your request, as ever may I thrive, there as my heart is set, there will I wive. And but you will assent in such manner, I pray you speak no more of this matter. With hearty will they swore, and they assent to all this thing. There said no wight nay, beseeching him of grace ere that they went, that he would grant unto them a certain day of his espousal, as soon as ever he may, for yet always the people somewhat dread, lest that the Marquis no wife would wed. He granted them a day, such as him lest, on which he would be wedded sickerly, and said he did all this at their request, and they, with humble intent, buxomly, kneeling upon their knees full reverently, him thanked all. And thus they have an end of their intent, and home again they wend. And hereupon he to his officers commandeth for the feast to purvey, and to his privy knights and squires such charge gave as him list on them lay. And they to his commandment obey, and each of them does all his diligence to do unto the feast reverence.
In part two, by the day appointed for the wedding, all preparations have been made, but the identity of the bride has not yet been announced. Then the Marquis astonishes his court with his choice of bride, a very poor peasant girl, Griselda, who promises him lifelong obedience. Oddly enough, there is no church ceremony. In time, the new Marquisess bears a girl child.
Not far from Thilke Palace Honourable, where as this Marquis shoop his marriage, there stood a thorpe of sight delitable, in which that poor folk of that village hadden their beasts and their herbergage, and of their labour took their sustenance. After that the earth gave them abundance. Amongst these poor folk there dwelt a man, which that was holden poorest of them all. But high God sometimes